Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Hospice New Zealand Genesis Oncology Trust Lecture Number 5. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. This morning there will be a presentation with question and answer sessions throughout. If you would like to ask a question at any time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I must advise you that this conference is being recorded, and at this time all participants are in a listen-only mode. Our speaker today is Dr. Jackie Kidd. Jackie is co-director of the Centre for Mental Health Research at the University of Auckland and is of Ngāpuhi descent. She is currently involved in several research projects, and we are delighted she joins us today to share findings from the HRC-funded study, Palliative Care, Health Literacy, Māori Communities Health Services Study. Welcome, Jackie, and please go ahead.
Thank you. Hi everyone. It is so bizarre to be sitting here. I'm sitting in my dining room completely alone talking to apparently about 50 people. If you do have any questions as we go on, I'll stop periodically and ask Jessica if there's anybody lined up so we don't have to wait till the end if you don't want to. Bizarre, also introduction, I suppose, with somebody whose background is in mental health. I came into this project as a late starter because the initial person, Dr. Sue Kringle, was actually leaving the university and needed to hand over the project. So with a new project team, we picked it up and ran with it. So what we've been doing, we picked up the project last sort of August, September, and went out and visited Māori communities around and healthcare communities around Auckland and the Bay of Plenty, to talk to them just about whether it was acceptable to go ahead with the research project and to talk about what their kind of general hopes were. And we were really pleased to, and I think very privileged to be allowed into the communities. So we spent the first part of the project going around talking to people about being in the project. And we were hosted by four hospice organisations. There was Waipuna in Tauranga, Hospice Eastern Bay of Plenty Whakatane, Hospice West Auckland and Mercy Hospice. So those four institutions, thank you, and I'm sure some of you are on the line, thank you so much for being so welcoming for us. And those institutions also helped us to access participants, and we've taken our interim findings back to discuss with those groups as well to make sure that we're on the right track. So based on those four organisations, we went out and we've done 10 focus groups, which included 55 specialists in primary health professionals. No, palliative care health professionals. Okay, so I'm reading my notes, which is a terrible thing to do. So 10 focus groups. We had 55 health professionals, ranging from kind of kaya whina right through to service managers, from general and primary, specialist and primary palliative care services. We had 6 key informant interviews, and we did 15 patient whānau interviews. We'd initially set up with the idea that if patients were interested that we could talk to them, but for the most part we've spoken to bereaved whānau. So we had 21 people in those interviews, and they were all recruited through their palliative care providers. So just to start out talking about health literacy, you'll see that most of the slides are quotes. It's really important to us that the voice of the participants come through in the research study. So we're trying really hard not to overanalyze what people have said and put words into people's mouths, which is why you've mostly got quotes. But anyway, we talk about health literacy in terms of the health organizations, our systems, as well as the health professionals as individuals and as professional groups and patients and whānau. Health literacy has been described as the degree to which individuals have the capacity to obtain, process and understand basic health information and services, and then go on and make appropriate health decisions based on that information. It gets a little bit tricky when you talk about making good health decisions or appropriate health decisions, because quite often those decisions are viewed as ones that are in line with the dominant thinking of the time. So we did find, just as an example, there was a large expectation that Māori whānau would want to have their loved one die at home, and that was seen as being a good decision, where the whānau who had a little bit more money or who had access to other resources and decided to utilise a rest home where a hospice bed wasn't available was a good decision for that whānau, but probably didn't line up with expectations of the health providers at the time. So it's a very individual thing, and I think one of the things that concerns me is that when we start talking about health literacy, that we don't take a checklist approach that says, okay, as a health professional, we know this is where they need to get to, and we're going to do if we do our jobs right, they will get to that decision, which we know that they should have made, you know, ages ago. So it's a dynamic kind of a concept, and it's a very complicated concept that has multiple layers depending on who it is that's receiving the service and how the service is configured, and then how the whānau is making sense of it. For health professionals, health literacy is about the ability to communicate health information and build skills and knowledge. A really big part of that in this study was about engagement. It was about how the health professionals went about creating that relationship that meant that it was possible, advisable, and good, really, to hand on certain kinds of information. There are times that I'll talk about a little bit later where information was given that was inappropriate. It was probably, from a health professional point of view, the right thing to do, but from a whānau point of view, not so much. So that relationship really comes into the whole idea of health literacy. For health organisations, health literacy is about the appropriateness of the health information and services that are provided for patients and whānau, as well as the organisational systems and processes to support health professionals to build health literacy. So that's about making it possible for health professionals who are working in the organisations to do their best job. It's about recognising barriers that come up for forming that relationship and for sharing information, and those barriers are often things like the mandatory requirement to hand out the health and disability legislation information pretty much at first contact, getting agreements signed when actually best practice from a Māori perspective would be that you don't need to do those things until maybe several visits in after the relationship's been formed. One of the reasons that health literacy is so important and that it's moved beyond, I don't know when you all trained, but when I trained, we just talked about education, patient education. Why it's moved on from such a single dimension sort of practice is that there's increasing evidence about the relationship between a person's health literacy and their health status. One of the other things that's really interesting about health literacy, I thought, and I don't know whether you're nodding or going to sleep out there, is that people who have really high levels of literacy, full stop, can still have very low levels of health literacy. It depends on their ability to navigate the system and to help and to make the system work to their own advantage. So some of the earlier attempts to quantify health literacy really did focus on written and spoken literacy, which only has some relevance. And in fact, we didn't in this study measure literacy. The Ministry of Health has already done a good job of evaluating and publishing about Māori health literacy being relatively low. but we were really interested to find that the whānau tended to be really resourceful in terms of finding the information that they needed to make the care work for their loved one. Persistently resourceful in spite of a whole lot of barriers, but I'll talk about that again soon. So anyway, that's kind of the health literacy definition that we've been working with. Are there any questions?
As a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
There we go. Okay, Jessica, you can jump in if there are a couple of questions. Okay. So when we talk to the health professionals in particular about health literacy, we've got the things like, we've got statements like, when you go into the initial assessment, you have a big envelope that's got stuff about the hospice and their rights and everything you can imagine. I don't think it gets read. The health professionals sometimes talked about having a big envelope of information or a folder of information or something like that that had to be passed on, and seeing that thing, that resource or whatever it is, sit in the same place visit after visit after visit and never get touched. I don't know whether it's a quote that I've got later on, but one of the quotes I found really profound from a family member was that after the mother had died, the daughters were cleaning out all the stuff related to her illness, and found the folder from hospice and sat there and read it, and thought that it was absolutely marvellous, but they hadn't touched it until afterwards. So there's something there about the timing and the delivery of the information to make it accessible to whānau. One of the challenges for health professionals is in this next quote, where the interviewer asks, how do you know when she, this is the mum, didn't understand stuff, or how did you know when you had to explain things? And the whānau member said she used to just sit there and smile and agree. And this is a whānau talking about appointments with doctors, and that how important it was that somebody should be there, because the doctor delivering the information thought that it was being really well received, and the whānau member could see that this was just a mum being polite and doing the right thing. And as far as they were concerned about not upsetting the health professional. One other nurse, I think, said, we support whānau in terms of navigating their options in a way that maintains their mana, and in a way that provides an opportunity to whānau to actually look at what are the choices that they make. Part of the choices, an informed choice, is actually ensuring they have information that's delivered in such a way that they can comprehend it. They can apply those options to their worldview and to their whānau context and what's actually happening, not necessarily to themselves. They'll always think about their whānau. A couple of really important things in that quote. The first one is the word navigator. I'll talk to you a little bit later about that, but that's a concept. It's not so much describing a role, but it's a concept that's come up time and time again in all of the interviews about having some assistance to work their way through everything that's going on. The other important thing is about the place of whānau, and health professionals have talked about that a little bit later on in the presentation, about the complexity of working with whānau and figuring out their way in. So there was a navigation issue there as well. Another health professional said that health literacy, the difference between what we say, between spoken and what's written and what's understood, and how people grasp what that actually means for them and their family, especially around the end of life, because it's such a big emotional event, that getting past the emotionality of that is having enough headspace to think about it. So health literacy is just what we live and breathe, whether we think about it as a concept or not. I think this is a particularly insightful person who's talking about this, because certainly there were other health professionals who you couldn't say that they live and breathe health literacy. It's more about, I have handed over that information, what they make of it is up to them. So this is a person who is actually, I think, adapting their practice as needed to make sure that the whānau doesn't just receive the information, but that they can interpret the information and turn it into something useful. This next quote is from a health professional who is speaking as a whānau member. People from hospice came out and explained to the whānau what needed to be done. What I found was the fact they showed them how to handle the patient, what to do, how they should be treated, even how to wash them. And they all took that in, and that helped my family. It was fantastic. Some of the nurses in particular talked about the beginning to form the relationship, perhaps while the patient was in hospital, and seeing that while the patient was in hospital, the whānau were handling all the physical cares. And so when the patient was discharged and sent back home, assuming that the whānau would then be able to continue with all of those cares, but the whānau having a crisis of confidence and feeling really unsupported and needing, in fact, to be shown again how to do all those things that they were already doing, but in a way that validates their ability to care for their loved one. There was a lot, I think, about the sense of responsibility felt by whānau, especially where there were one or two caregivers in the whānau selected, or it became their role to be the main caregivers, that they would feel like they were accountable for all of their decisions and all of their caregiving to the rest of the whānau, which actually makes the whole caregiving experience really complicated and more stressful than I think it is in smaller whānau. Okay, so the next thing, we separated some of the data into a kind of chronological order about before access to palliative care, during care, and after the death of the loved one. So this next section is about what happens when whānau come into palliative care. we found that there was confusion about the meaning of palliative care, hospice and end-of-life care. In fact, confusion among the health professionals sometimes, as well as the patients and whānau. Definitely a fear of the unknown. For patients, a resistance in putting it off and sometimes needing that navigator role to help them get through the door. Viewing hospice in particular as a place to die, and once the word hospice was mentioned in conversation, perhaps with a nurse or a social worker in the hospital, almost a switching off of all the information that came after that. So even where people were being offered in-home hospice support or hospice assessment or something like that, they just heard, it must be time for me to die, and I'm saying it's okay to die if I allow these people into my life. So there was a really strong sense that by resisting hospice care or hospice intervention of any sort, people were also resisting death. So the two of them, when they're hand in hand like that, create something that's really powerful, I think, in people's minds in terms of why they should not receive care. It's not, they haven't even moved beyond that to thinking about this could make me more comfortable or this could make my mum more comfortable. They're just thinking hospice equals death, I'm not ready to die, therefore no hospice. So there's something about the navigator, about somebody who can help them through that says, that brings up some of the philosophy of hospice and the uses of hospice so that people can recognise that without necessarily attaching imminent death to it. In that beginning bit about the confusion about the meaning of palliative care, that fits in with this next point, which is about when is the right time to access hospice. And even among some health professionals, there was a view of hospice being a place to die. Obviously, this wasn't the hospice nurses. This was other services. So there was, I think, one or two services that really did try and hold people away from hospice, almost viewing it as the final, this is where you go and you won't be coming out sort of thing. There was among some, it didn't come from, now I can't remember, there was some data, some information, but I can't quite remember where it came from, that people did believe that hospice is there to hasten death. That particularly came up around things like changing the way morphine's delivered or increasing a morphine dose, that the nurses were not invested in helping somebody live a good life or die a good death, but they were actually interested in hastening death. So that was quite a strong belief that came through, but from a small proportion of the data. There were particularly people who had already had some kind of involvement in palliative care. There was the view of hospice as a place of respite and letting the whānau have a rest. There are layers of things to unpack there about the whānau having a rest, about whether they should. I mean, whānau members being completely and utterly exhausted but feeling like they should be able to keep going kind of 24/7, and that it's somehow a failing on their part to need to sleep. In bigger whānau, where there were lots of people involved and there are roster systems working, that worked really well. But for smaller whānau or places where whānau were really busy and the burden rested on a couple of people, the need for hospice to be viewed as a place for whānau to have a rest was really well received. And also, the more the whānau knew about palliative care and hospice prior to it ever being raised in the context of their own care, the more readily they seem to be able to accept it, and I guess that's not a surprise to you. Some of the quotes around that idea of people coming into palliative care, one patient who was one of our few patients who participated said, "I was the odd one out, the Māori, they do look down on you," and this was her experience of coming into hospice. Another said, "Well, you know, when I was growing up, we had to take a plate, whether it be a bread and a butter, and that's the thing. I think hospice has got to let them bring what they want to bring instead of saying, no, it's all right, they've got it all here. That's not the issue. The issue is, this is something I brought to share." So we're talking there about a cultural cross-communication where hospice, with the best of intentions, is saying, no, don't bother yourself. You don't need to bring a single thing. You just bring yourself and we'll do everything else. So there was no sense of reciprocity and no sense of, for this person, for this patient about being able to belong. Another said, we have a big family, like lots of grandchildren and stuff, and they didn't mind us all being there. You didn't feel like you're not allowed to go up there. So this was a hospice, an inpatient hospice environment where the family felt incredibly welcome. Another said, it's a good thing that they have a whiteboard and it told you who was on. We could talk to any of them about if we had a question or anything. The thing about them was they were quite straight up with you, so you can prepare yourself. Even though it was scary, it was still good. So I think that probably cuts to the heart of the health literacy in terms of health professionals being ready and available to have those conversations. And, I mean, as a nurse, I know that you look at the whiteboard sometimes where you write up your name next to a patient and think, what's the point? Well, this whānau is really saying very clearly, keeping those things absolutely up to date and having people knowledgeable about the patient that they're named alongside of and being willing to talk to the whānau actually means a lot. One of the nurses there, we're interested in who they are, not just their disease. That came through from all of the health professionals, even where it was clear sometimes that skill didn't quite match up with what they wanted to be able to deliver. There was great interest in people as people and in whānau as individuals who all had their own needs and health professionals willing to work around what that whānau needed. This next quote, who is talking about overcoming some of the systems barriers in terms of how many people she's expected to see in a day. She says, I saw the same patient yesterday and I spent, it would have been like 4 hours at their house and getting this rapport, and then today I was there for 10 minutes. They figured out the driver. Most patients, I have to do that every week. They were just like managing, and because there was just so much whānau, it was full of women, beautiful women, and they all just wanted to know how to work it. And it seems once the trust is there, you're fast and efficient. This has been also a theme that's come through, and it's what we've just been calling, and it'll be really familiar to you, is the idea of front-loading time, of recognising that to form that relationship, you might need several visits. Some of the nurses in particular talked about needing to visit maybe 2, 3, even 4 times before cancer was even mentioned. That it's about dropping in and getting to know people and saying, what do you need? And about some of the resourcing things about, and that I go on to that a bit later, about the sometimes the whānau need for a piece of equipment is the way in the door, but you won't get that request in the first visit, but you might get it in the second visit, which then gives you permission to keep going back, so you end up forming this relationship that then means you can start talking about deep and meaningful things like pain levels and some of the more, I guess, socially embarrassing aspects of being really ill and about how whānau are coping. So there's all of those things, much less the where are you going to die conversations. On the next slide, does the ethnicity of staff and service matter to whānau? The short answer is yes, it does. But the longer answer is it does possibly doesn't matter as much as we sometimes think. In terms of the absolute ideal service, it was about being within a Māori context. It was about not having to interpret things. It was about belonging immediately. And they talked about the richness of connection. And this this quote, they spoke Māori to him, and that was just major. That was actually about the first responders to an emergency, and that was a fire brigade, local fire brigade. But it was about that sense of being in a place that knows who you are. There was a lot of amazing, you know, really good stuff about care from hospice, and the words that you'll be familiar with of, you know, she was just an angel, we couldn't have done it without her. One of the other really good quotes I thought was that the people who were really involved in the care were really lovely and really informative, so that the whānau stayed involved and felt like they had kind of the finger on how things were going. There was some conversation from some of the whānau in particular about people who used their ethnicity, I guess, to kind of bypass some of the getting to know you stuff. So they talked about the disrespect of Māori not using whanangatanga and being pushy and overfamiliar. And they talked about Māori, non-Māori being judgmental and clinical and sterile. One of the health professionals said, I can't do that, all those Māori pronunciations and things very well, but I can still love and I can still do that really good, and as long as I'm genuine, then that's all I can work on. I see where she's coming from with that quote, but she's not quite right. Yes, she has to be genuine, but she still needs to keep working, and I guess that's one of the things that I'll be talking about a little bit too, which is about the whole hospice environment being very white, middle class, and female. One of the nurses said, I think to me that translates into slowing down and acknowledging to myself that there's going to be more time required to get to know them. The things that are already known and don't need to be spoken when you share a culture, you need to have the time to develop some stuff, and it's about us getting to know and about standing still quietly and being known. That's a really wordy kind of a quote, but that's the next stage. It's not just that you have the best intentions, but you have the best intentions and then you work on things that you can do that that enable people to get comfortable with you. So it's like, you know, the first nurse or the first health professional saying, you know, that she can love and she can be genuine, but then the next one saying, this is how I can do that actually in practice. What do palliative care providers do that helps and hurts whānau? We had a long list. I have to say probably that there were clearly some horror stories. Most of those didn't involve hospice. They mostly involved either hospital care or the transfer between hospital and hospice, excuse me, where people sometimes got a bit lost or services actually wound up working in opposition to each other. Some of the things that the whānau found really useful were the resources. That was a really big one. Teaching and affirming whānau care activities, always turning up, being a person rather than a robot, advocating and explaining. The things that whānau really struggled with that we've put here as hurting but in fact created barriers for them in their health literacy efforts. Lack of information, inaccurate information, inconsistent information. Those were sometimes health professionals giving different messages. There was concern about the change in staff when people become much more acutely ill or when they're much more complex, that the whānau may have gotten to know one particular care team, and then as that care team is overstretched and can't come in sort of once or twice a day, that other people start coming in, but those people don't follow the processes of getting to know the whānau. So again, it's about the front-loading time. So whānau just suddenly find themselves overwhelmed with strangers, where maybe for the last few months in an ideal world, they will have developed this really close relationship with people. So then you get the kind of adrenaline-filled, now I'm here, what shall I do, sort of feeling that, and the whānau start to feel like things are out of control. Not listening to whānau experience and knowledge, they found that really difficult, that sometimes their expertise in terms of caring with their whānau member was overlooked. Being impersonal, I have a personal bugbear about the being impersonal and the robot thing, because I think that our professional codes of conduct are in direct contradiction to what a lot of our whānau need. I think that we are training people to be too distant and we're not teaching them how to be present and safe. So we're working the boundary as though it's a brick wall. We're not teaching people how to breach that wall but keep themselves safe at the same time. Inadequate care and lack of informed consent. Again, those mostly came from hospital areas. One of the stories that happened in hospital, he's going, help me. We said, give him morphine. And the nurse said, the nurses won't give him morphine. The doctors won't give him morphine, I mean. And that's when I realised that DNR, the do not resuscitate, wasn't about not reviving him. It was about that they wouldn't assist him if he couldn't breathe. That's a whole different scenario. And he didn't know that. I didn't know that either. All the time we were told that this would be a peaceful passing, and it wasn't. And I watched him, and I watched this poor nurse who didn't know what to do. He was mouthing, help me, the whole time. And I realised then that they knew this was going to happen. The next few days at his tangi, we just couldn't get that image out of our mind. this was a person who was in the high dependency unit in a hospital and had throat cancer and was moved. He signed a DNR and then was moved into a ward where there was minimal intervention, and it was late at night, and clearly the nurse didn't know what was going on either. So the whānau are still processing what happened there. This is a hospice story. I was quite upset that they'd done that to Mum. What they had done, in fact, was discharged her from a particular part of hospice service because she had lived too long. That's probably not quite right, but in effect, she had been receiving this hair and makeup service for longer than hospice was able to accommodate, and so hospice kind of moved her on out of that. And this whānau member says they don't understand. What they don't understand is that Mum and all of them in the program, they were looking forward to going, and it wasn't just about what they got, it was mixing and mingling. I was thinking, God, Mum had more of a social life than me because she was always bloody darting off here and there. After she finished, she went sort of downhill. That quote's in there not as a, it's not that I want, or that we wanted to make a point about hospice care being poor. It was more about the mixed communication around contracts and service delivery. There was the on-the-ground staff who were caring for that person in the whānau would have been able to say, this is more about hair and makeup. But that wasn't an opportunity that they were given. So there are, you know, systematic systems issues in terms of how services are being delivered. The final statement in this kind of area is about not having enough time. If you're in a rush, I think it does worse than good. It shows you have no respect for that person. Again, yeah, it's about the in a rush thing, because staff did talk about sometimes you do have lots of time, sometimes you don't have very much. But if you go in there and say, I'm just popping in, I've only got 10 minutes, but I'm popping in and we can make a time and I'll come back and spend some more time because this is terrible, but I did want to say hello. That's different, I think, to racing in and trying to do everything all at once. And it's the same kind of concept that you have at the beginning of the relationship, which says, I need to get to know you and you need to get to know me before we start having these difficult conversations. So I think that's something too that we could improve in terms of how we teach our health professionals about how to engage with people. Any questions?
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that's star one to ask a question or make a comment. And also, Dr. Kidd, we have had a request if we are able to remind participants which slide we're up to in the program.
Oh, great.
And there are no questions at this stage.
Okay. The slide that I'm looking at the moment is headed up navigators. And it's probably about 18, around about slide 18. The idea of navigators came through loud and clear in terms of the navigator role is a paid role, which is only occurring, as far as I'm aware, in one kind of area. Well, it certainly was only one experience in our data. But also whānau members who've been previously involved, whānau members who, or friends who have worked in palliative care and can give people some advice about how to manage things. Anybody in that kind of role really made a huge difference to each whānau in terms of how they were able to access service. One of the whānau who did use a navigator said, I was trying to take notes, and then the navigator just took my book. So I could listen. She did all the notes for us, and I really appreciated that. And by the time I got my book back, she had all the phone numbers in it. She had everything I needed. And someone else who's talking not about the navigator as such, but a person who was in that, kind of taking on that role for the whānau, she was always keeping a step ahead of us. Like, she knew what questions we didn't know to ask, and she knew that soon we'd be needing certain services. So they'd contact us, or she'd give us the information and we'd contact them. She was saying, do this now. Don't wait till it gets worse, so that you've got a rapport with these people before you need them. That comes back similarly to what I was saying before about helping whānau to predict what's going to happen when more care is needed and when a regular nurse has days off or a social worker is going on leave or something like that. so that the next group of people who come in are also known to the whānau. This was also about needing increasingly complex specialist care and going to see that person, that consultant, whatever it was, in preparation for when it was going to be needed. So that was really useful to the whānau. The next stage that I've got there, the next slide, what do whānau need to know about palliative care and how do they find out? We actually have turned that into a series of tables that talk about the health literacy demands for patients and whānau receiving palliative care. And it won't surprise you one little bit to know that it's absolutely enormous. We did separate it out into information that they needed, almost disease-focused information that they would need around medication and disease management, symptom management and things like that. Then there was another layer that was about health systems management. It was about going between services, going between health professionals. And then there's another layer that's about changing whānau dynamics and grief and loss. And for some of the whānau, it was about how you engage with schools to make sure that children weren't disadvantaged if they needed to be home when somebody was dying, that they weren't written up as kind of absent and they weren't abandoned in terms of what needed to happen next for the kids. And so it was all of those sorts of things as well. So absolutely huge. And I will be able to send out to the participants anyway a list of those health literacy demands. One of the whānau says it's been hell. I didn't know what palliative care meant. I guessed it meant dying, but what does it mean? No one explains anything. They give you pamphlets, but no one says this is what this one does and this is what this one does. Hospital, GP, public health nurses, district nurses, hospice, chemist, and most importantly, what they don't do. Oh, we don't do that. Well, who does and how do I find out about that and who do I have to talk to about them and when and where? There's so much information and it's so confusing. We found the idea that health professionals and health services are not really good at saying what they don't do. We found that quite profound, really, and kind of identified that as one of the areas that people can fall between the gaps because they think that somebody is going to be able to continue to provide that care. And then something changes and they can't, and it catches the whānau by surprise, and they don't necessarily know how to engage with that next level. One of the whānau said, we had a big folder where if you asked us for any medical records, anything, prescription slips, we've got it all organised in tabs. So what do you want? We were trying to get the doctor to don't talk to us like we're idiots. Talk to us and explain to us what you're looking at. This whānau actually went on to say that the dad who had cancer was someone who, if whenever something came up, would research it to the extent that he could do surgery on himself. So the whānau were living up to his standards in terms of how much information they had and how they went about making decisions. And they found that it took a lot of effort to get the health professionals they were working with to recognise their level of expertise and work with them at that level and not just instruct them. Another whānau says, this is a horrible story and it happened in hospital, thank goodness. It's about a couple of sisters who arrived with their dad who had a fistula that was actually spurting gunk and they were really frightened and they ended up sitting in the emergency department and the palliative care registrar was sent down to have a look at them after they'd been waiting in ED for a really long time. And the guy said, we've actually got a meeting now, so we'll be back in just over an hour. So I started writing down, and I think I looked at the time, and I wrote down the time, and he goes, well, what are you writing down from me? You make people nervous when you write. And actually, I had that said to me by about three people at the hospital. He goes out, and he comes back in, and he goes, oh, it's 2 o'clock now, I'm having my lunch. Do you want to write that down too? So the level of, I think, uninformed hostility by, thankfully, very few healthcare professionals is something else that came out, obviously, as a real barrier for whānau. Some of the whānau, this is a slide called self-informed care. Some of the whānau said things that I thought were wonderful, like there are times when I do listen, when a doctor makes sense to me. They used long words and didn't explain, so I'd try and remember what it was and write it down and then look it up on Google on the laptop the older kids gave me every night. I kept a diary every day of what the doctors and nurses said. I needed to do that to make sense for me and my family. I think all of those points actually provide us with some clues about what, as health professionals, we can do to help people to become more engaged in their care and to improve their own health literacy. So some of the suggestions that have come out from health professionals where we've taken these findings back have been about providing people with the right websites to go to. You know, if you Google some things, you're going to get the horror stories and you're going to get some really dodgy kind of information. But if we, as health professionals, provided people with a list of, look, these are the really good websites if you want to know more, if you need more information than I'm giving you, or you want to prepare yourself for our next meeting, these are the ones that I would recommend because they're the ones that fit with the New Zealand context, they fit with standard medical advice, and they don't send you off drinking green smoothies. So there are some things there that we could do so quickly and so easily in terms of our practice that would improve health literacy. So what are whānau saying now? These are some of the sections, these are some of the quotes from people who, after their loved ones have passed away. One whānau said, I'll never ever feel below a nurse or doctor. They don't know all the answers. They're not there 24/7 with your family member and they don't know as much as you do. I would have asked a few more questions. I probably would have been a little bit more assertive. Our doctor never rang back. This is a GP. This is one that we have a personal relationship with. Never rang and followed up to see what we'd done. Here's us saying on the phone to him, he's not breathing. And he never rang us personally or his nurse. And I was disappointed, yeah. I thought at least he would have rung back to say, what have you decided? Did you call an ambulance? Another whānau member says, and look at now, if anything happened now, I go and Google it, eh? When my mum passed away, my mum's sister ended up getting cancer too, so I passed my notebook on to my cousin, saying, take notes from here, cousin, so that you know. Yeah, I gave all those to my cousin. So this is a person, and the next one is about taking on that whānau navigator role. I've been able to do the same thing now for my brother-in-law and his family too, so it sort of paid off. And we did find that among whānau members, and some whānau members were in focus groups as health professionals as well, that they often talked about that kind of pooling of resources and that somebody in the wider whānau would take on that role of being the one that the rest of the whānau could go to talk to about what's going on and get some advice. So again, that's that navigator thing that I keep coming back to. Getting on to the last slide, I think, what are the service and workforce issues for palliative care staff in relation to health literacy? One of the things that came up over and over again in the focus groups was about hospice being a self-identified white middle-class female organisation. Excuse me. I think there are some, you know, clearly there are some issues there. One of those is that I think on reflecting back, now that we've got a bit of distance from the focus groups, on reflecting back, it's almost as though the staff who were talking about that were doing it in such a way that meant we can't change, we're doing the best job we possibly can and we can't do it any differently, which is a kind of a helplessness thing, which I think can be overcome with different kind of staff education and different kind of system support for staff to begin to experiment with practicing in some different ways. Certainly some of the staff who self-identified as white middle-class female were doing some amazing work. So I think there's some work to be done there on encouraging people to expand their horizons a bit in terms of how they look at the world. And I think, too, that there's a level of fear around cultural competence and around what that means for nursing practice, that somehow I think as health professionals doesn't seem to affect the doctors quite the same. The social workers seemed to be able to be kind of working around that, and it was a part of what was expected. The nurses seemed to be the ones that were really struggling. And to a certain extent, they're right in terms of where hospice has been historically positioned. But there were also some quite sadly racist thinking around Māori don't like coming here because it's really clean and really pretty and they're not used to it. And some staff saying that we don't like really having all that many Māori in here because it kind of messes the place up to have these big families hanging around. Sorry, I'm choking here. So those are not strong findings coming through from the research. Those are comments that have come from health professionals, either in the focus groups or in the hui later, where we took the findings back. So they're not strong evidence. So they're not going to be kind of put out there as, you know, we've got a group of health professionals who are racist. It's just that there are some organisational things, systems things that we can do that make those attitudes more difficult to hold and make it easier for the staff when they're creating these connections to do it in a culturally competent way, that so that everybody feels safe. And I don't know whether I've covered that well. So if you've got any, I'm sure we'll talk about it. Anyway, I know we need to get moving. So that kind of covers into the recruitment and training that doesn't support cultural diversity. Poor links to Māori communities, and I know that in a lot of the focus groups, people talked about their attempts to make links in, and it is very difficult. So there's something there, I think, that's almost a national kind of need to strengthen those links, and how we do it, don't know. The historical focus on cancer and motor neurone disease has also, I think, potentially created a little bit of a knowledge deficit in terms for highly specialised hospice staff in terms of other illnesses that might come in. Inconsistent definitions of palliative care, especially around life expectancy and associated service provision, it's a contract issue. It's a thing that I think disadvantages people on the ground who are wanting to provide a particular kind of care to whānau, where their contract might say, we don't do that. And also ambivalence about generating Māori referrals, not as specifically Māori referrals, but as additional work when services might already feel like they're pretty much at capacity, and going out and actively seeking a whole new part of the community to come in can also be quite anxiety provoking. The last slide is a blank slide about document analysis. In fact, the focus groups participants told us exactly what we needed to know about the documents, which was that some of them are brilliant and some of them are awful, and that's exactly what our analysis came up with. There wouldn't be any surprises in there. What's more important than the actual resources is how they're delivered, when they're delivered, and who they're delivered by. So any time a resource is delivered to a whānau and somebody who has a relationship with them sits and goes through it and then leaves them with a phone number, the whānau was satisfied. So spending, you know, an absolute fortune redoing all the pamphlets without also attending to how those are delivered and how staff are supported to improve health literacy for whānau would be a waste of money. Okay. I'm done.